You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there and welcome to this, The Agenda's podcast from the 28th of June. Thank you for downloading. Please do make sure you subscribe so you don't miss out on a single episode. Now on the programme today, we discussed the impact of this summer heat that we're facing at the moment on our delivery drivers. Now, quite a lot of measures have been introduced by the government, but we wanted to hear what the delivery companies themselves are doing to help their drivers. So we spoke to Talabat and Deliveroo, and we also heard from a driver themselves about how they find working in the heat. Meanwhile, two astronauts testing out Boeing's new Starliner spacecraft are stuck in space after it faced technical difficulties. Space engineer Yusuf Farouk from the Sharjah Academy of Astronomy, Space Sciences and Technology talked us through how those astronauts are going to get home. Meanwhile, two teens from Dubai-based schools are headed for the Paris Olympics. They're going to be representing Jordan and Eritrea in the swimming events. Karen Belbasi and Christina Rack talked us through their training schedules and their excitement. And the first US presidential debate has taken place between Donald Trump and Joe Biden in this electoral cycle. Professor Adam Ramey from NYU Abu Dhabi gave us his commentary on that conversation. Joe Biden's performance so far being panned as a slow motion car crash, even by members of his own party. And we found out the secret of a quality political speech with Flo Akinbiyi. He's a presenter and communication coach. He's worked alongside Michelle Obama and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Right, it is getting hot out there. To state the obvious. Although it is slightly what everyone is talking about, isn't it? It is really hot at the moment. And funnily enough, it doesn't really feel like the humidity has ramped up quite to the level that it's going to. But the thermometer hit 50 degrees officially in Fujairah a few days ago. And certainly, although there is some rain forecast in the south of the country today, I'm looking out of our big window here in Dubai. And I mean, there isn't a cloud in the sky and there isn't a breeze either. And I have to say, I rush to and from my house and my car. Basically, my life is about moving as quickly as I can between air-conditioned boxes in this heat. I pretty much don't stand outside in it for more than about 20 seconds. And the reality for our workers who have to be out there in it, I mean, it's around this time of the year that you just feel so sorry for people. I feel guilty about it. I might as well be honest. You know, I see anyone out there having to do any type of manual labour and I feel bad for them. I feel really bad for them. I think you'd have to be slightly inhuman not to feel bad for them. And there are lots of measures that are introduced in the country, you know, that people acknowledge the fact, the government fully acknowledges the fact that it gets too hot. They have their midday break initiative. It takes place from June the 15th until September the 15th. That means that from midday until 3, no one is allowed to be working outdoors. But of course, that can't apply to everyone. For example, it can't apply to the delivery drivers because they, although they could have that break, and I'm sure, you know, no one would mind if they took it, the reality is that that's the busiest day, the busiest time of the day for them. You know, everyone wants their lunch between 12 and 3. And as far as I understand it, our delivery drivers eat what they kill. That's a sort of business breakfast expression for they make money on the jobs that they complete. And the government is aware of that. And as a consequence, they have opened 6,000 air-conditioned rest areas for delivery drivers across the UAE. They're in all sorts of different places because the ministry knows that it's not like all the delivery drivers are in one place at one time. The bikers have been given these interactive maps to help them locate and access the rest stations. And they've been developed in collaboration, not just with the government, but with also with Talabat, Deliveroo, Dubai's Roads and Transport Authority involved, the Integrated Transport Centre in Abu Dhabi, and then also the various economic development departments. But what is it actually like there? Like, what is it actually like out there on the roads? Now, let's find out. I'm joined in the studio by Lucy Cormack. Now, you might not have met Lucy yet. She's a brand new addition to the Agenda team. Lucy, good morning. Lovely to have you with us.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here. Now, yesterday you went out in the heat to actually speak to a driver, to find a driver to speak to about how they find things. How did you actually manage to catch up with somebody to chat to?
Yeah, Georgia, I was on my way home and I, you know, I just stopped at the supermarket car park, and it's sort of around a lot of apartment blocks. So you've got delivery riders coming and going at all hours of the day. And I approached one rider who had just made a delivery. And I was very grateful he was so willing to talk about his experience and his work, because, you know, with Dubai's huge food delivery culture, I really feel, I look around the roads and I see these guys and I think they keep this city running, you know, they keep people fueled. So, you know, for him to take a moment to speak to me in what is a very busy and difficult work day, I was very, very grateful.
Oh, it was amazing that you managed to catch somebody, because I think so often we don't hear from the people who, like you say, keep their city moving, you know, attend to our every needs. You know, if you want a bar of chocolate delivered in the city, you can have it delivered within 15 minutes.
Absolutely.
So where were you actually chatting to me? You said you were in a car park. So,
yeah.
Gosh, it must have been hot.
So it's an outdoor car park. It's concrete, you know, for miles. No shade really, you know, beyond over the cars. And it was just before 5 p.m. It was about 37, 38 degrees Celsius, baking hot. So no shade. My skin is burning. I'm sweating. And I'm just standing out there for 5 minutes, you know. So what must it feel like to spend all day riding in it, working in it, you know, just no escape really until the end of a 12-hour shift.
And wearing the helmet and the protective gear, like they just, I mean, they might get a tiny bit of a breeze whizzing along, but
totally.
I mean, no, it's awful. I just feel for them so much.
Yeah, well, that's right. And I guess, you know, I really wanted to get a sense of that and what it feels like. So I spoke to this delivery driver from Burundi, and we've decided to keep his name anonymous, but he has a really, really interesting perspective and great experience to share.
Many people don't like this job because we get many accidents. In 1 month, you can fall down like two times like this. So maybe once you broke your arm or you get an injury like this.
How much more difficult is it for you doing your deliveries, doing your job when it's this hot?
This summertime, it's not easy to work. For example, this mobile I'm using, when I put a location, I'm going to my customer. I go like 5 minutes, maybe from where I am to my customer. It's maybe 20 minutes or 15 minutes. So I start going after 5 minutes. It gets full because it's too much heat. So that time I have to stop to refresh my mobile so that I can continue. So in that case, I can reach to my customer late because I stopped in my way when I'm going.
Because your phone is overheating,
yeah,
because it's so hot.
I think I stop, I refresh it, then I continue maybe after other 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
That must be really difficult for you to maintain when you have so many deliveries to do in a day.
Yeah, it's difficult because maybe before, when it's not heat like this, I can make 17 or 15 orders. By that time, because I met these difficulties, I make like 10, 12 like this because this problems happened.
And that affects how much you can earn?
Yeah, it depends on how many deliveries I made per day. Maybe if today I make 10, I can earn maybe 100, 120, depending on how many orders I make on this day.
And just finally, how does it feel riding around in the heat? And do you get a chance to stop in any air conditioning?
Yeah, this is another third problem we met again. You see now it's overheating, see? So your body also, it's not easy to walk under this sun. Right? Sometimes you feel your body is not okay. You need to take a rest somewhere where maybe there is AC so that you can take rest.
And do you know that they've started opening rest areas for drivers with AC?
Yeah, for our companies they tried. They put some areas that we can use for our rest. But for example, I come here now, I can pick up another order, I drop it to another place. It's not easy to go to this area they prepared for me to take rest.
wow, you get a sense there of just how keen these drivers are just to keep on the road, to keep doing as many jobs as they possibly can. Lucy, thank you very much indeed. I mean, amazing to hear there from one of the drivers. I think too often, I presume that we don't have a shared language. I think too often I presume that people can't speak English and therefore I don't talk to people enough, except when they actually come to the door. And I have to say, whenever a driver comes to my door, I do give them a bottle of water, I give them a juice. But the reality is that they are finding it very, very difficult out there. Now, we're going to talk to a couple of the big delivery companies on the programme today, because obviously they're fully aware of the heat and I'm sure they have plenty of measures that they implement every single summer. And I'm delighted to say we're actually joined on the line now by Chris Karimari. He is a senior manager of third-party logistics and rider management for one of the biggest companies that hires delivery drivers, of course, Talabat. Chris, it's really lovely to have you join us on the line. How are you?
I'm all right, Georgia. How about you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm really interested to know what measures you guys introduce during the summer to sort of help your hardworking delivery drivers deal with the temperatures.
First of all, thanks for having me, Georgia. At Talabat, we've always had the riders' best interests in mind, which is why we always constantly work with our fleet partners to enhance their safety and well-being on and off the roads. So there are two main things that we are doing, primarily the solar-powered rest areas and the summer buses. So starting with the solar-powered rest areas, it started last year when we came up with this idea to launch the first in the region solar-powered rest areas. With the wonderful, wonderful support from Abu Dhabi Mobility, previously known as the ITC. And these rest areas are actually a reflection in the commitment and the joint efforts between the public and the private sector, ensuring the health and safety and well-being of all the delivery riders in the UAE, not just Talabat. So I would like to take this opportunity to, you know, thank our great partners from the government, like Engineer Sumaya Al-Niyadi, Mr. Ibrahim Al-Amari from the Ministry of Human Resources and Emeritization, who believed in the idea and supported us in implementing this across three locations in Abu Dhabi. And based on this success, it was only right to expand it even further this year. With our strategic partners from Emirat, especially Mr. Ali bin Zayed Al Falasi, who was keen on deploying the smart boxes across Emirat gas stations in the country to contribute to rider welfare. So these solar-powered rest areas are equipped with free water dispensers, mobile recharge stations, and a built-in air pump, so that the riders can check their tire pressure. So that's it on the solar-powered rest areas. Now on the summer buses, we launched about 15 air-conditioned buses, providing more flexibility to relocate based on the changing concentration of the riders across the country, which ensures that all delivery riders have access to the rest areas to relax, recharge during summer.
I mean, it's lovely to hear about those rest areas being introduced and of course so important in this heat. I suppose one of the biggest challenges that you guys are facing is the nature of the job means that your drivers need to be out in the midday heat because they want to carry out those deliveries and everyone wants a delivery around lunchtime. Do you ever advise them on how to stay safe in these really high temperatures?
Yeah. Yes, we do. So we always encourage all our riders to take breaks between orders and shifts at the rest areas, all right, be it the buses or be it the solar-powered rest areas. And they also have the option of resting at the air-conditioned restaurant partner premises when waiting for orders to be prepared and before heading to deliver to the customer. And this month in June, we ran a full day workshop for the riders jointly with government partners, like the Permanent Committee for Labor Affairs in Dubai, and the Ministry of Human Resources and Emeritization, and the Dubai Police. And this workshop was called the Delivering Excellence. And the sessions at this workshop included, rider road safety tips, during summer, and where we highlighted the best practices for the riders to implement, you know, in order to balance the demanding delivery times and ensuring that their health and safety.
There was a time when restaurants were, how do I put this, frankly, a bit snotty about letting drivers take shelter, maybe come into the restaurants when they're coming to pick up orders. Have you sort of developed relationships with restaurants to try to encourage them to be more welcoming to drivers?
Yes, we have. And I think it's also a joint effort, right? So together with not only just the restaurant partners, but also with our government partners, you know, as you mentioned, we're contributing over the 6,000 different rest areas across the UAE. We've also working, you know, internally with our, you know, our Talabat Cloud Kitchens and our Talabat Marts, right, where we're providing about 49, you know, of these rest areas. And we have received massive support from our restaurant partners. We equip their premises, you know, with facilities riders can utilize while waiting for their orders, you know, to be prepared. And it's because of these efforts, you know, we're seeing a growth in the trajectory. Like, we are seeing more and more, you know, restaurants, you know, becoming part of this initiative.
So, Chris, I actually don't know if we've spoken before, but I've definitely spoken to someone, I think from Talabat, a very senior guy who actually, I think it was Talabat, gosh, I hope I'm not getting this wrong, who actually tried out being a driver. He actually went there out on the road and saw, you know, what it was like at the front end kind of thing. And oddly enough, he mentioned the same thing that our driver who we just heard from, that it's really difficult getting your phone to operate in this temperature. Is that something that you guys have considered helping your drivers with? It sounds like it's something that really bugs them on a sort of hour by hour basis.
Exactly. Yeah, I think I am familiar with the guy you're speaking of. Based on this, on his feedback, and also based on the feedback, like the rider from Burundi you interviewed, Lucy interviewed, we did start installing windshields on the motorcycles, and these windshields are specially designed to try and block the heat and try and block, you know, the sun rays and protect the phone from overheating so that they can continue delivering their orders. So it is something that we have taken to heart, and we are definitely making an effort towards that.
Yeah, it was actually, I was right. Thank goodness I was right. It was the Talabat CEO, Tomaso Rodriguez, who actually went undercover as a delivery driver. Now, this is a hardy perennial when it comes to the questions that I ask you guys who are in charge of the delivery companies, because everyone wants to know if a guy like the person we just heard from Burundi is only earning about 100 dirhams a day on a hot summer day, tipping becomes ever more important. You know, anyone listening to that will be like, oh my goodness. I mean, realistically, I spend 200 dirhams a day if I'm ordering a takeout for my family. I can't believe that, you know, the disparity in wealth and fortune in that situation. And the best thing that we can do as customers to help your drivers is to tip them. Do they get the tips that we put onto the apps, or do we need to be tipping in cash?
Yes, tipping is a gesture 100% from our customers, and the riders keep 100% of their tips. And just to add on top of that, in what else that the customers can help the riders, especially in these summer months, is that to be a part of this, you know, is just showing kindness to the delivery riders. So even just this conversation that Lucy had with the rider, maybe to us it does seem like it was an interview, but it was actually a conversation. And as you know, as humans, we are social beings. So just having that conversation is actually showing kindness, and it was very, very nice. So thank you for that, Lucy. And in addition to doing this, you know, whenever you're receiving, you know, your chocolate bar, as you mentioned, Georgia, is, you know, offering, you know, a cool drink or offering water, you know, to the riders, greeting them back, you know, just showing them that, you know, we do acknowledge and we do recognize and we do appreciate them. All of these things, you know, in conjunction with the tips, goes way beyond than we imagine.
Chris, really appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the radio today to talk through the various measures that Talabat are implementing in order to help our delivery drivers during this very, very hot summer period. That's Chris Karimari, who is a senior manager of third-party logistics and, importantly, rider management for Talabat. Chris, thank you so much for your time. Hello there and welcome back to The Agenda. Right, we are discussing the realities of this very hot summer temperature heat on those amazing guys who are out there doing our deliveries. The government has introduced alongside all the delivery companies 6,000 air-conditioned rest areas for the drivers across the UAE. So it's the Ministry of Human Resources have teamed up with Talabat, Deliveroo, Dubai's Roads and Transports Authority, the similar body in the UAE. So everyone has clearly realised, both private and public sector, that something needs to be done to help these riders. But the truth of the matter is that it's really bad out there. It's really hot. It's really horrible. And I think most of us who live in this city can just, our hearts are going out to these delivery drivers. And as a consequence, we're really keen. And I know that lots of people have been texting in. We're really keen to find out what the companies themselves are doing to help their riders. Now, brilliantly, two of the biggest companies have come on the radio today. They're quite happy to talk to us. We just heard from Talabat. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined now in the studio by Yazan Abarkabe, who is Director of Operations at Deliveroo. Thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
Thank you for having me, Georgia.
Yeah, so I'm really interested to know about the realities for your drivers on the roads during the summer. Are they still pretty busy or does it all get quite quiet because everyone leaves the city?
You know, as it stands, I think they're still quite busy. I think there's, you know, there's business enough for them to earn a good amount. I think the focus though for us is in the summer, as you've just mentioned, it does get really hot. And we're part of an ecosystem where we feel like we need to do everything we can to make their lives a little bit better. That, you know, when they're on the job, they can be more comfortable, they can feel a little bit more supported. So this summer, as we've, you know, done in previous summers, we've rolled out a whole lot of initiatives to try to support them throughout the summer. And this comes both in conjunction with a lot of our partners in the, on the government side, so the Ministry of Human Resources and Amortization, the RTA, Dubai Police. But we've also worked internally and have been surveying riders and speaking to riders throughout the year. So it's a, sort of a combination of these things that we've tried to implement. And this year, you know, we've launched a series of both mobile and fixed rest stops. The mobile rest stops are basically buses that we have across the country. We make sure that we cover the entire country or everywhere that we operate in the Emirates. And these buses are designed to provide rest areas for riders, designed for us to distribute things like refreshments and water for riders during the summer. And if they do have a break or they would like to take a break, they can always use those rest areas for them to do that. In addition to the mobile sites, we also have our additions kitchens, our hop sites. These are sort of our dark stores that we have across the city and in Abu Dhabi as well. And in those facilities, we also have areas where they can sit down, refill their waters, you know, take a break, cool down a little bit before they go on to their next order.
What was so interesting hearing from our rider that spoke to Lucy from Burundi, who we've chosen to sort of keep his name anonymous, I mean, just in case, you never know. It's just nice for people to have their privacy in many ways, is that he mentioned that although he has been told by his company that these rest areas exist, and so that's a big tick for the delivery companies, you know, they know that they're out there. But the truth of it is that he is working too hard to stop at them, or they're not necessarily in the places where he needs them. And what it comes down to is that he eats what he kills. You know, he gets paid for the jobs he does. And right. So he wants to push on through, kind of thing. And it's those drivers who are pushing on through that I suppose we're all most worried about. Do they have, you know, do you encourage them to take water breaks because of their health? Do you teach them that they need to stay healthy because they're on these rickety bikes? Well, no, I'm sure perfectly serviceable motorbikes, but you know they're on their motorbikes. You know, you worry that if they get too hot, you know, it could be a real problem.
Yeah, good question. Look, I think there's two things here. I think one is there are mandated breaks. So we in the summer we make sure that we provide them breaks for them to cool down, to take a break, re-energize, refresh, and then get back to work. And we also communicate with them very, very regularly throughout the week, almost on a daily basis, reminding them of things to stay hydrated, reminding them of things to make sure that they are, you know, protecting themselves from the sun whenever they can, whenever they have a break or during their mandated break. And like I said, we provide them with, you know, as many facilities as we can for them to be able to do that and not have to inconvenience themselves throughout the day. So we place our buses in locations where we know are sort of hotspots. And, you know, if we just look at last year, for example, we did a similar thing. We had thousands of visits on a monthly basis, thousands and thousands of visits on a monthly basis. And that just means that we're sort of getting it right in terms of where we're putting these buses in rest areas. And they are using them. And so to that, I would say there are mandated breaks and they are encouraged to take breaks throughout the day to make sure that they don't sort of overwork themselves or overheat, essentially.
Yazan, it's so lovely to have you join us in the studio. If it's okay, we've got to go to the news headlines now. So can I keep you with me for another few minutes?
Absolutely.
We're going to come back to you. There's lots of questions coming in, which I can also put to Yazan in the break, and then we can get them answered for you. So if you've got anything you'd like to ask, please do message us on 4001. Or, of course, you can WhatsApp me on 048717550. Sorry, I say that so many times a day. You can't believe I'm getting it wrong. 048715500. And yet we will be speaking again with Yazan Obarakabe, Director of Operations at Deliveroo Middle East. And you never know, if I'm given another two chances to say his surname, I might actually get it right. Hot topic today is quite literally about the heat and how it affects our amazing delivery drivers. I'm just going to read some of these messages. This person says, "Hi, Georgia. Our business receives lots of deliveries. So we actually developed a free sustainable water bottle, which we give to the delivery drivers, and they can get cold water when they come to the office and refill it as much as they want. Our clients are also keen to get involved. So they actually sponsor the bottles, which is a very lovely idea." Muma says, "Are there limits on the number of journeys that the delivery drivers do? We'll find out about that in the next few minutes." Sadiha says, "I always keep cool drinks like Laban or chocolate milk boxes or fruit juices so I can give them a cool drink with either a biscuit packet or a fruit. Nobody goes from my place without something. Treat people as you wish to be treated with respect and dignity." Meras has suggested, "How about a surcharge during the hot weather so people might be inclined to delay their lunch in the summer?" That is a very interesting suggestion there. Thank you very much indeed. Now, we do still have our guest in the studio. Yazan Obarakabe is Director of Operations at Deliveroo Middle East. Yazan, thank you very much for staying in the studio with us. Tell me, yeah, lovely to have you here. What are the biggest problems your drivers tell you that they face over the summer, and how are you sort of managing them?
It's obviously the heat.
Yeah.
Right, during the summer. And all of our initiatives that we do during the summer are designed to try to keep them cooled down, rehydrated, refreshed, etc. So I've mentioned obviously the buses and the rest stations that we have. Throughout the summer, we also distribute sort of seasonal kit items for the summer that help them out. You just mentioned reusable water bottles. We distribute those to riders as well. We have different areas around the city where they can go and refill the bottles. And then in addition to that, we give our riders something called a cooling vest. And so the cooling vest is something that while they're riding, the way that it's used, that they basically put it on top of their kit, and it can bring down their body temperature by up to 10 degrees, which is great. So the objective for us is, whether they're, you know, seated in our buses or in our additions kitchens or they're on the road, how can we keep them sort of cooled, refreshed, rehydrated, etc.? One more thing about the buses. Actually, this year we did a partnership with one of our lovely partners in the country, Humantra, who's at Electrolytes.
I've just started trying them. I don't want to advertise them too much, but
great.
Yes.
Yeah, they're great. They're great. They're great. They're one of my favorites, to be honest. But we did a partnership with them for our riders in the summer. And we have something called the Hydration Station, which is, you know, a very large bus that we have parked outside different locations in the city. In addition to the water that we give them, we also give them hydration electrolyte packets from Humantra, so they can, you know, be even more hydrated throughout the summer. So, you know, we're always on the lookout for different things. We're always on the lookout for innovative ways to keep riders hydrated, to keep riders feeling supported, feeling, you know, cooled down. So this year, Humantra was the first one that we did. And like I said, you know, we're always on lookout for things throughout the summer.
Right, we're turning our attention away from local news for a bit to really quite global news. In fact, we're going out of this world because two astronauts are testing Boeing's new spacecraft. But unfortunately, it's not gone to plan. They are stuck in space due to technical issues with this brand new Starliner. It's a new style of Boeing craft, and apparently it's having issues with its thrusters. There are leaks of the helium gas, which pushes fuel into the propulsion system. I mean, you can tell I'm a space scientist just from that. NASA says that the astronauts, who are called Sunny Williams and Butch Wilmore, are apparently in no danger. They're just on board the International Space Station. So how serious are these, in inverted commas, technical issues? And what does it actually mean for their journey home? When are they going to get home? Does it matter if they're stuck up there for a while? Joining me now is space engineer Yusuf Farouk. He's from the Sharjah Academy of Astronomy, Space Sciences and Technology. Yusuf, it's always lovely to speak to you. It doesn't look very good for Boeing, this, does it? You know, brand new spacecraft. They've managed to get up there, but they haven't got back yet.
Well, how does it look? How does it look like for Boeing? So, to us as space engineers, when it comes to human space flight, we like to take very well calculated risks. So, first of all, we try our best to do all the testing here on the ground, but then nothing beats what happens in space. I always love quoting this from the former U.S. President Kennedy's, that we're going to space not because it's easy, but because it's hard, because it's the goal is to measure the best of our energies and skills. So we do our best to try to simulate the space environment here on the ground. You know, we have some vacuum chambers that we throw our instruments in and we do the testing. But however, when the spacecraft is in space, it's a whole different ball game. Space is very unpredictable to a certain limit. I mean, you know, but how does it look like? So as per NASA's last statements, they're not stuck technically. They're just keeping them there until they can figure everything out, make sure that the spacecraft, and according to them, the spacecraft looks like it's very solid to do a return. So just in case an emergency happens, they can use that spacecraft to go back to Earth. However, they're just keeping it there so that they can get in more data, because you don't often go to space. And then while we're at it, and then while our systems still look good, we might as well try to figure out what went right. And then what went wrong? Because, you know, let's say we decommissioned this and then we're not going to have that access to space anymore to give us those data and then all of those parameters that we need to improve our space flight. I mean, like, we've been to the moon on Apollo 11. It took us like 11 attempts to make it happen. So space is hard.
Space is hard. Will they be okay up there? They were only expected to be there for a couple of days. Is there enough beds and food? Because they're basically bunking in for longer now. It's like the housemates that never leave.
Well, technically, at that point, you don't really need beds in space.
If
you have a body mass here, and like, of course, you have a body mass there, up there. But if you're sleeping, you're just floating around. So technically, you don't need bunk beds. Food and everything, resupplies can be done by SpaceX. So it's not that their stay is indefinite, but then new calculations have to be in place. So it's not a big of an issue. Plus, you know, according to NASA estimates, looks like they're going to be heading back on the 4th of July.
Okay. So meanwhile, another big space story has hit the headlines. Turns out that Elon Musk's SpaceX has actually been hired to bring down this International Space Station at the end of its life, which is actually supposed to be in the next decade. It's a contract worth nearly 850 million. Was it billion or million?
Million.
850 billion would be too much. And they're actually, what are they actually going to do? First of all, why do they need to get rid of the International Space Station? And secondly, how are they going to do it?
All right, so let's start by stating that the International Space Station was built around two decades ago. It was launched in parts, you know, hand in hand with, you know, the US and Russia were working together on making the International Space Station happen. In the face of, you know, going back, you know, after the Cold War, they started working together on those projects. So the International Space Station is, yes, it has been beneficial. It's our manned mini lab up there in space. We've been able to send astronauts, including the UAE astronauts, tons of U.S., Italian, Russian astronauts. So it has been an invaluable tap to space. So now the technology has been kind of outdated. Plus, you know, talking back to our previous story, there has been more access to manned systems. Like, you know, SpaceX has been doing manned missions. Boeing has been trying to do this manned capsule, and now they're on the International Space Station. So access to space has become slightly more easier. And then the maintenance cost of the International Space Station, just keeping the space station running, costs around the U.S. taxpayer around $3 billion every year. That's just for the U.S. And you know, got to keep in mind that we're working hand in hand with Russians and other international organizations. So the operational cost has become really high. And then keeping in mind the advances of sciences, if we're taking a look at our current, let's say, mobile phones, our mobile phones now are way better, tons better than what we had 10 years ago. So bringing it down is an operational thing so that we can work on and upgrade. The Chinese actually have a manned space station separate from the International Space Station that's currently in operation now. So
it's so interesting that ultimately it's over time, even the most modern, extraordinary vessel or craft can actually end up becoming outdated. Really interesting as ever, engineer Youssef Farouk, to get you on the radio. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Youssef is a space engineer with the Sharjah Academy of Astronomy, Space Sciences and Technology. And it turns out that Elon Musk is going to create a vehicle that's actually going to push that orbiting platform, the International Space Station, into the Pacific Ocean. So that's actually what's going to be going on over the next decade. Now, as Youssef explained, it's becoming redundant. Do a big focus on local news here on the agenda. But this international news story is so big and it is dominating so many of the headlines around the world that we couldn't ignore it. Basically, it's Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Now, they've faced each other in the first presidential debate of that US 2024 election, which is going to take place in November. It was an hour and a half. They debated on TV and it really got very bitter very quickly. Now, the two candidates were blaming each other for things like high inflation. They also argued about, you know, abortion, the Russia-Ukraine war. Immigration was a big topic as well. But what really stands out from the debate is that Joe Biden was really struggling with his voice. And that was even at the outset. This is his delivery of one of his very earliest answers.
With dealing with everything we have to do with, look, if we finally beat Medicare.
It was a very difficult moment. And while he did recover a bit later in the debate, there are some people in the Democrat Party, which is Biden's party, who are very worried about his performance. Now, his team say he has a cold, and that was the reason for his voice being really quite hoarse. But as you can hear there, he was really stumbling, and there were some really random topic changes in his conversation. The 90-minute debate, carried on despite that really dodgy start. And Donald Trump and Joe Biden did engage in some really notable exchanges on the economy. So Donald Trump was arguing that Americans are actually worse off than they were now than when he was in office.
We had the greatest economy in the history of our country. We had given them back a country where the stock market actually was higher than pre-COVID, and nobody thought that was even possible. He has not done a good job. He's done a poor job, and inflation's killing our country. It is absolutely killing us.
But the truth of it is that Joe Biden's performance is what everyone is talking about now. Some members of his own party have described it as a slow motion car crash. The Biden campaign co-chair Mitch Landrieu spoke to NBC immediately afterwards.
I think that he's fine. I think he had a cold tonight. I think he looked a little sluggish when he came out, but as the night went on, I think he really kind of rose to the occasion. It's going to be a very, very difficult night. It was a bare knuckles brawl, but I'm proud of the fact that he stood up to Donald Trump and the mistruths that he told.
So there you go. There, some people think he did great. Some people think the opposite. So what does it all mean? Earlier, I sat down with Adam Ramey. He's an associate professor of political science at NYU Abu Dhabi. And he says the debate was not what he was expecting at all.
It was the most memorable presidential debate that I've seen in my lifetime. I thought with no audience, the format shutting off the mics after the candidates were done speaking that it was going to be pretty boring. And the second that President Biden started to try to answer the first question, I just gasped. I couldn't believe what I was seeing.
There are rumors now, at least on CNN, that, you know, the dust has settled over the last few hours slightly. There are suggestions that the Democrats might even be considering replacing Biden as a candidate because of his performance. For those people who didn't see it, what was so bad about it?
Look, President Biden, to win this election, needed to make two cases to the American public. Number one, that President Trump was a terrible president, a number of different dimensions, and that he would be a terrible future president, whether we're thinking in terms of the economy or social policy or foreign policy. The second thing President Biden needed to do is to assure the American public that even though he's 82 years old, that he's capable of continuing in office for another 4 years. And, you know, his age wasn't brought up until later on in the debate, but virtually from his first response, he was completely lost and felt flabbergasted, rambled on. I mean, former President Trump rambled on his own, to be sure, but he was not uncharacteristic. But I think with Biden, the American public got to see firsthand just how old he is. And it was painful to watch at times, I would say, because of it. And so, yeah, I mean, it would be unprecedented for the Democratic Party to try to change the nominee this late in the game, particularly with the sitting incumbent president. But I think that top Democratic strategists have got to at least be seriously considering that President Biden is just not simply not up to the task.
Do you think that is the main takeaway out of this presidential debate? Because in many ways, you might have hoped that, you know, we'd be talking about the economy, we'd be talking about migration, that we might be talking about Donald Trump's conviction, for example. But it does seem to be that Biden's mental acuity is top of the headlines.
Yeah, we have a former president who is found guilty in a criminal proceeding. That is unprecedented. And yet that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the fact that the person who's running against him, the person who's the incumbent in the White House, seems completely unable to put together a coherent statement to take advantage of that very significant softball and knock it out of the park. Every cutaway that the CNN cameras made to President Biden, he looked lost, tired, confused. And I think that Democratic Party officials should be shaking in their boots at this point. If your opponent is somebody who was very recently just found guilty in a criminal trial, you can't just use that as fodder to wipe the floor with them. That's very concerning. And, you know, a lot of people in advance of this debate, me included, couldn't understand why the Trump campaign was willing to accept the terms of the debate, because usually presidential debates in the U.S. don't take place until the fall, usually late September and then into October. There's usually 2 to 3 of them. This is a very early debate, and it's highly unusual, partly because the Democratic and Republican parties' conventions, where the formal nomination of the party's candidates for president happens, they haven't even happened yet. They're not happening until later in the summer. But it was a fait accompli, and CNN negotiated with the campaigns. And the Trump campaign gave away the idea of having audience participation. They gave away the ability of the moderators to shut off his microphone. And a lot of people, like I said, including me, were skeptical. Like, why would the Trump campaign agree to this? And maybe they knew. They just had a hunch that once the American people saw 82-year-old President Biden on TV, no matter what he said, no matter how persuasive the substance of what he's saying might be, that a lot of people are going to look and say, this is not somebody who's capable of serving another 4 years.
Yes, you mentioned there the style of the debate, because, of course, it was in a studio, so you didn't have the audience, and Donald Trump loves an audience and really feeds off that. And also, after 2 minutes, the mic would stop working. And so the audience, although you could carry on talking, the television audience would not be able to hear it. And we all know that one of Donald Trump's tactics is to talk over his opponents. And like you say, that was also taken away from him. I mean, did Donald Trump manage to land any really good accusations against Biden? You know, what were the sharp sticks that he was using to poke Biden?
I think Trump did a decent job making the case, as it is his duty to do in order to win, that the average American was economically better off 4 years ago than they are today. The inflation is out of control. Wages have gone up, but they haven't kept up with inflation. They certainly haven't kept up with food pricing and housing and now interest rates. So even if you wanted to buy an inflated priced house, you couldn't because the mortgage interest rates would be simply too high for the average American family to be able to afford. And that was what Trump needed to do. And I think he did it. And that was his common message. And Trump said a lot of other things, too, that Biden challenged during the debate. And I'm sure that in all of the major news networks, after debate analysis, they're going to refute many of the things he did. But he made this claim, and it is empirically true. And a part of it is the pandemic. There's a lot of other things there. But the Trump campaign needed to make the claim, you were better off economically 4 years ago. And, you know, under this guy, you've been worse off. And by the way, he's also incompetent. And on the one hand, by taking away the audience from Trump that he feeds off of typically was definitely a cost. On the flip side, because of the lack of that audience injection of energy into him, Trump actually seemed a bit more subdued than normal. And so I think that maybe it actually indirectly helped him. It made him seem a little bit more calm, more measured. You know, he made some jabs against Biden. But if you think back to, for example, the 2016 debates with Hillary Clinton, in which Trump would just completely, when it was not his turn, just say fake news, lock her up, et cetera, et cetera. That wasn't happening. And so Trump might actually appear to some folks as more presidential than they might have in the debates that happened in the last two cycles. Just on the polling alone before this point, it was advantage Trump. And I think right now, this is Trump's election to lose, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, we here in the UAE are slightly observing this as political entertainment in many ways. I wonder how this impacts on the US and people's perspective of the US as a global power. If you've got two candidates who seem so unappealing outside the country, does that impact on the United States' global standing?
I think it most certainly does. The United States, for much of its history, but particularly in the period after World War II, sort of stood as this example in terms of how our democratic institutions work, the idea of respect for the opposition, even if we don't agree with each other, we have peaceful transitions of power, we collaborate together over issues of vital national security. And moreover, there was perhaps an unspoken consensus that the president of the United States is the leader of the free world. That was the term that we would use. And there are still many countries around the world that look to the United States for that example and for that leadership. And I think the fact that the two candidates that are facing each other to lead the United States for the next 4 years are both older than the three previous office holders before them. The idea that Bill Clinton, who hasn't been in the White House for a quarter of a century, is younger than both of these gentlemen tells us that there's something particularly wrong with American politics. And whoever wins, it's not going to be a great victory. I think that undermines the United States' image in the world, especially thinking about areas where the United States is able to have a major impact in mediating massive conflicts around the world. Think just in the last 25, 30 years, whether it's helping negotiations between Palestinians and Israelis, between Sinn Féin and Protestant forces in Northern Ireland, global climate crisis, you know, from issue to issue to issue, the United States has been looked at as a major source of legitimacy for mediating in major conflicts. And my greatest fear coming away from this is that a lot of people around the world are going to look to the US and say, maybe this isn't the great power, whether we think in terms of hard power or soft power, that it used to be. And I think that that's very unfortunate.
That is Professor Adam Ramey from New York University, Abu Dhabi, where he specializes in political science. Fascinating to get that reaction to that presidential debate, making headlines quite literally around the world. That first sort of proper US presidential TV debate took place in the early hours of this morning. That was in Atlanta, Georgia. And while everyone now does seem to be talking about how President Biden was struggling with his voice and chain of thought, before the debate, President Trump said he was actually planning to use ChatGPT or AI to help compose his argument. Here he is speaking really weirdly to the YouTube star turned boxer, Logan Paul.
I had a speech rewritten by AI out there, one of the top people. He said, oh, you're going to make a speech? Yeah. He goes, click, click, click. 15 seconds later, he shows me my speech.
That's crazy. Written. That's crazy.
So beautifully, I said, I'm going to use this sucker. I've never seen anything like it.
What'd you say to your speechwriter after that?
Yeah, I said, you're fired, Vince.
Poor Vince, he's fired. And I suppose realistically, if these politicians are happy to use the AI large language models, then yep, speechwriters will be out of a job. It is a slightly disconcerting scenario though, isn't it? If you've got half the world's population voting this year, how many of the politicians around the world are going to be turning to AI to help express their so-called authentically held views? And I have to say, I would suggest that with trust in politicians at an all-time low, surely this is a recipe for disaster. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Get in touch. I'd love to hear from you. 4001. I mean, are we never going to hear classics like this again?
I have a dream that one day, this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
Of course, that's Martin Luther King with the famous I Have a Dream speech. Obama also made a very, very famous speech more recently.
It's been you who fueled my dogged faith in our future, even when the odds were great, even when the road is long. Hope in the face of difficulty, hope in the face of uncertainty, the audacity of hope. America, you've vindicated that hope these past 8 years.
Okay, joining me in the studio is presenter and communication coach Flo Akinbiyi. Now, he has worked with everyone from Michelle Obama to Arnold Schwarzenegger. Flo, thanks so much for joining me in the studio. Fabulous to have you here. I mean, realistically, do you think artificial intelligence could ever write either of those two speeches that we've just heard?
Well, I really have to answer with a little bit of yes or no.
Oh my goodness, I thought you'd just say absolutely not. That's
no.
So unexpected.
No, because it's all about what you put into the AI. And when you put in great content, great examples, and you give it enough context, it can actually do surprising things. Now, of course, I will say that the human touch is what we need. And also, if you just put a lot of data and a lot of information and a lot of structure into it and say, that's the first draft, I'm happy with it, you won't get to that level. But if you then do 10, 20, 30, maybe 150 rounds, maybe then we could get to such a speech, because it's, if you work hand in hand with AI, it's possible.
I am so surprised to hear that approach from you, because normally if anyone talks to me about AI and, you know, it replacing radio broadcasters, I'm a bit like, they've got no soul. It's impossible. I also want to get reaction from you to the debate that we've just had this morning between those two. Those two politicians. I'm trying to think of, I was going to say those two old men, but I think that makes me sound a bit pejorative.
It's true.
It is true. Do you think they performed well in your professional opinion?
I mean, when it comes to Joe Biden, I really felt a bit sorry for him, because bless him, he's 81. And you can definitely see that his health has deteriorated over the years. And if you just compare it to a few years back, it's no surprise that this is what we see today, because there's, in the months and year leading up to this debate, you see how he really, really had a lot of trips and falls and he stuttered. And what I found amazing about Joe Biden, fascinating, that he was able to overcome his stammer. And throughout his career, he's been a great speaker. But now the stammer comes back and you can even see it in his face. So Joe Biden's performance wasn't really strong. And it's not the performance of a strong leader that can lead the country out of a difficult situation. So that's on the one side. And then on the other side, you have Donald Trump. I mean, he is Donald Trump. And I really have to echo what the professor Adam said. He did do a decent job.
He did
do a decent job. And his performance, I mean, his health is good. Although you can see that he's aging a little bit, but still, his health is good. His voice is strong. And content-wise, he got a few points across and he repeated them. So therefore, for me, even though I don't want to really say it, he was winning the debate.
Trust in all politicians now around the world is at an all-time low. Can they use their speeches to connect with an audience? You know, can a quality speech change someone's political future?
Yes, it absolutely can. And There's one trend that I see more and more around the world, and you also see that on social media. It's a trend of being authentic, and that's also one of the reasons why Donald Trump is successful, because, I mean, he's definitely delusional, but he believes what he's saying. He believes what he's saying, and that's also what creates this magical connection with the audience, which people sometimes strive to or can't understand, which I struggle as well. But authenticity is a really big key word right now. And that also means that we don't necessarily need the best written speeches, the most rhetorical devices and every content thought through 10 different times. Sometimes we need people that we can trust and follow. And that's where I think that politicians, they can make with the right speeches and, of course, the right content and preparation, a big impact on their votes.
Flo, it's really lovely to have you join us in the studio. We thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Georgia.
That is Flo Akinbiyi. He's worked with everyone from Michelle Obama to Arnold Schwarzenegger. He is a presenter and communication coach. Thank you for your time. So here on the agenda, we have got Olympics fever. Yeah, little known fact, that is the Olympic fanfare. I don't think anyone would immediately recognise that, but believe me, by the time we've finished with you at the end of the Olympics this year, you'll recognise that because we are very enthusiastic about the Olympics here on the agenda. Earlier this week, we actually met the Emirati show jumper Abdullah Al-Mari. He's going to be representing the UAE at the Paris Olympics. It all kicks off on the 26th of July, so we've got under a month to go. There's about 10 athletes competing for the UAE, and we'll definitely be following their story over the summer. But they are not the only people heading to Paris from our shores. In fact, two, would you believe it, teenagers from the Dubai-based GEMS Wellington Schools cluster are going to be competing. They're going to be representing their home countries in swimming events. And I am absolutely thrilled to say I've managed to grab both of them. They come into the studio and they're going to be doing an interview with us over the next 20 minutes or so. So I've got 15-year-old Karen Belbasi.
Hello.
Hello. Karen is going to be representing Jordan in the 400 meters freestyle event. I'll just say that again. 15-year-old Karen.
Yeah,
you're
15.
Amazing. And then I've also got 16-year-old Christina Ratch from Eritrea, who is going to be competing in the 50-meter freestyle event. Christina, welcome. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so you're both blowing my mind because you're literally a third of my age and you're going to be representing your countries in the Olympics. I mean, it's just the most exciting thing in the world. You both train here in this city with Hamilton Aquatics, so they must be pretty impressed with themselves as well. And I just want to find out everything about how you've managed to get yourselves in this extraordinary, amazing position. So, Karen, I'm going to start with you. When did you start swimming? When did you know that you were going to be good enough to be competing at this level?
I mean, I started like swimming for fun as a sport when I was around 4 years old. And from then, like I stuck on. I started getting competitive at around 9 or 10 years old. And it was always my dream to be in, like, to go to the Olympics. And it's finally come true and I'm super happy.
I mean, it must be such a journey. Christina, is it similar for you? Did you start at a young age?
Same with me. I agree with Karen. So I started when I was around 4 and then I've kind of carried on with Hamilton for like the past, I guess, 12 years, swimming with my brother competitively. It was kind of always just a thing where my mom wanted to keep me safe in the pool, but then obviously with Hamilton, it just kind of became competitive.
How many hours do you both train a week? Christina first.
So I train 7 to 8 times a week in the pool, and then we have 3 like gym sessions, like 2 dry land and 1 actually in the gym. And each session is kind of, it varies, but it's usually 1.5 to 2 hours.
So Karen, I bet they've got you on the same program,
yep,
right?
Yep, same exact.
And so, I mean, how, you are really giving your life to this sport then. You know, you're really working incredibly hard on it. You're going to be representing your countries. How difficult was it to qualify? Karen, how did that all happen at 15?
To be honest, like, there were many swimmers in Jordan. I had to travel a few weeks ago to Singapore to qualify, and I got some times I was really proud of, and from there I qualified, and honestly, I think it's the best thing I've done so far in swimming.
So was it slightly unexpected?
Yeah, it was unexpected, totally unexpected.
Oh my goodness, so you trained and trained and trained, ready for this big competition in Singapore. How did it feel when you got, when you were, I'm trying to think, what's it called? Are you on the diving board? Are you on that, like, where are you at the starting line?
Yeah, so like after the race, I was shaking. I was so happy, like, the feelings I felt were like crazy. I was so happy. If you told me what, like 1 year ago today or from the start of this year that I was going to the Olympics, I think you'd like, I think you're joking. I wouldn't believe you.
I mean, I love that story. I love the fact that it's unexpected and that you're going to be going to Paris. Christina, was it a surprise for you as well?
For me, so last year, like my coach kind of brought it out to me that I had the opportunity to represent Eritrea to go to these big international competitions. So this year and this season was all about going through these international experiences. So I traveled to Ghana for African Games. I traveled to Qatar for World Championships. And then after Qatar, my coach kind of thought that the Olympics was an option for me. So, yeah.
I mean, how does it work? Does your coach get in touch with your government and say, hi, I got these great swimmers?
No, actually, my mom got in touch with the, like, the swimming federation in Eritrea. And then from then on, we just built a lot of connections from there. So, yeah.
And was it the same for you, Karen?
Not really. So 2-3 years ago, I started in the Jordanian national team. And from there, I went, like, I gradually attended more international competitions with them. And from then on, now they selected me for the Olympics.
Oh, so that's really interesting. You had more of a sort of solid relationship with the country from the start, whereas Christina, you sort of joined the team sort of slightly later in the day. We're going to keep you on the radio. I'm absolutely fascinated to learn more about how you keep yourselves sort of under control mentally, because the stress and the pressure on you guys must be really immense. And you know, I keep on reiterating it, but you really are quite young to be going to the Olympics. Okay, we're continuing our obsession with the Olympics on the agenda now, because I've got two young teenagers from Dubai-based GEMS Wellington School Cluster in my studio. And thank goodness I've got them now, because in 3 weeks' time, they are going to be heading for the Paris Olympics, where they will be representing their home countries in swimming events. I've got 15-year-old Karen Belbasi. She's going to represent Jordan in the 400 metres freestyle event, which I've now learned is an endurance event. I also have 16-year-old Christina Ratch from Eritrea, who will be competing in the 50 metre freestyle event. I'm so thrilled to have you both in the studio. I'm so excited for both of you. You both seem so together. But have you found training at this really high level hard? Karen, I'm going to come to you first.
I mean, I definitely find it like it's like high intensity right now. And, you know, sometimes you might feel tired, you might feel like demotivated, but you know you have that end goal. And once you like imagine yourself in that dream and like living what you want your reality to be, there's no way I'm not going to train as hard as I can or anything, because I know that I want to achieve something.
So if you're getting up at 5 a.m. to go for a training session and you're like, I can't be bothered, that you will have that mental discipline of, but I know where I'm going.
Exactly.
I mean, that's so cool at your age. Christina, is it similar for you? Because I know that your competition is slightly different, so your training is slightly different, because you just have to go really fast.
Yeah, so I agree with Karen. Some days you don't have the motivation at all, especially when you have to wake up at 4 a.m. to go to train.
4 a.m.?
Yeah. and obviously what we do is completely abnormal, so people don't usually understand the difficulties of what we have to face on the regular basis. So I feel that we have to have that mental discipline to understand that we have to do what we have to do to eventually get our end goal.
Yeah, it's not like you can just go out for burgers with your friends and stay up late if you're getting up at 4, because you need to think about your diet, you need to think about your you said you go to the gym as well. Is that quite a big part of it?
As a sprint, like swimmer, we have a lot of gym sessions. We have two dry land sessions and one gym session in warehouse. So it's focused a lot on power exercises. So, yeah.
How do your friends feel about this? I mean, I'm not going to, I imagine your family obviously incredibly proud, et cetera, et cetera. But what about your mates, Karen?
I mean, I think my friends were completely shocked. I don't think that they would think that this would happen. They're like, what, the Olympics?
Yeah.
Like, they didn't understand. But like, they definitely support me a lot. They understand, like, sometimes if I can't go out with them, if I can't text them as much, they're like, yeah, we understand. I mean, our friend's going to be an Olympian. So yeah.
It is the coolest thing. Christina, you the same?
I just don't think they understand, like, the full capacity of what we're actually doing.
Yeah.
Like, they're just in complete shock and disbelief. So, I mean, I am too. I'm still processing that. I'm still going to the Olympics. So,
yeah. I mean, it is huge. I think I've only ever met one other person who's been to the Olympics, and he was a swimmer as well, actually, and he did it years ago. And he actually showed me his medal. I think he got bronze. But I mean, I remember that, right? Like, I'm 45 and I often don't remember the people I've met. And I remember this Olympian. So it just shows you how it really is a standout moment, and it will be the most extraordinary moment in your lives. What are your biggest hopes? Do you dare to hope for a gold? I hope you do. You deserve it, Karen.
I mean, yeah, that's obviously my dream. But I think right now, like, my goal, just to enjoy the experience. I mean, I've worked really hard to get, obviously, to the Olympics. And I mean, everyone supported me. My school especially, GEMS Wellington Academy Elkhill, they've really supported me through this journey, and Hamilton Aquatics. And I think everyone knows that right now, it's just like enjoying it, because there's nothing else you can do.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Absolutely. Christina, so I suppose in many ways it's about trying to live in the moment.
Yeah. Like, this is the biggest stage, like the biggest international stage that our sport like offers. So I think it's all about like enjoying the moment and embracing like the international experience and seeing all the swimmers. So yeah.
And buying all the souvenirs.
Yes.
Because you guys you're going to be competing in the 2024 Paris Olympics. You want the key ring, you want the t-shirt, you want the cap. I guess you'll get special national swimming costumes and everything, and the whole team will rally around you. Are you looking forward to meeting other people from, oh my goodness, you'll get to do the march around.
Yes.
Yeah. You'll get to do the whole thing. It must be so exciting, the idea that you're going to meet other elite athletes from your countries. Is there anyone that you'll be looking out for, do you think? Or are you just getting to know who else is on your teams?
I mean, swimmers, Katie Ledecky, Summer McIntosh. Obviously, I want to meet them.
Me too.
All the famous swimmers, basically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You need to take, what do you get signed as a swimmer? Do you get your hat signed or your towel?
Yeah, you can get anything signed.
Amazing. Girls, I can't believe it that you're going to be going over there. We will certainly be following you every single step of your journey. So I hope you guys can do interviews with us in Paris as well. Maybe not immediately before your swims, because, you know, you need to get into the mental headspace. But congratulations to both of you. And thanks for joining us on The Agenda. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
So that was 15-year-old Karen Belbasi representing Jordan in the 400 meters freestyle event, and 16-year-old Christina Ratch from Eritrea, who'll compete in the 50 meter freestyle event. Amazing. Now, if you've got any comments on any of those stories, please do find us on social media. You can either go to Dubai Eye 1038FM or you can find me. I'm at Georgia.Tolly on most social platforms. And make sure you subscribe so you don't miss a single episode.